Hello and welcome to TDF Talks, a fortnightly podcast from The Design Files, Australia's most popular design blog. I'm Lucy Fagans and I'm the founder and editor of The Design Files. Today's episode is brought to you by Mercedes Me. On the corner of Collins Street and King Street in Melbourne, Mercedes Me is a cafe, event space and concept store operated by Mercedes-Benz in partnership with St. Arlie. The Design Files hosts regular events in the space, including TDF Talks at Mercedes Me, and this podcast is part of that series. Our conversation with Paul West was recorded live at Mercedes Me last week. Just a reminder that this is an enhanced podcast. That means it has pictures. If you listen using the Overcast or Pocket Casts apps, you will see relevant images and links in your player while you listen. It was so amazing to sit down in front of a live audience last week and chat to chef, farmer, and sustainable living advocate Paul West. Paul is best known as the hugely popular host of River Cottage Australia, the beloved TV series bringing the sometimes idyllic, sometimes challenging realities of farm life to a national audience. But before River Cottage Australia, Paul cut his teeth working in all areas of food production, from growing fruit and veg to woofing, which stands for willing workers on organic farms on various properties across Australia, to working at wholesale markets, retail grocers, and at top restaurants, including Vue du Monde. Paul hosted River Cottage Australia for 4 seasons, and after the show wrapped up, he moved to Newcastle before settling in Melbourne with his family, where he's been for the past year and a half. It was such a joy to meet Paul and to chat with him about his career and his philosophies on food and on sustainable living. What surprised me most was just how hilariously funny he was. He had me and the audience in fits of laughter for most of this conversation, and he certainly knows how to tell a good story. To River Cottage, which I do want to chat to you about. I'm really keen to understand a little bit about your early career and I guess, you know, what brought you to what you're doing today. So what did you sort of study and what were those early years like before you started doing what you're doing now?
So between home and kind of River Cottage now?
Yeah, so like I guess through when you finished high school, what was your path like?
I think the number one thing I applied for on my HSC university application was a degree in nanotechnology at UTS. I liked the sound of it. Surprisingly, I didn't get into it. The only thing I got into was my last preference, which was kind of a bottom scoop just in case. And it was the Bachelor of Business at University of Newcastle. And I got there and I did about one semester and I went, oh, this sucks. No offense to anyone that's got a Bachelor of Business in this room. It just wasn't my particular cup of tea. And then so after that, I just started doing odd jobs. I cleaned Navy boats in Sydney Harbour. I was a performer at a theatre restaurant, like a rip-off of Dracula's in Newcastle. Because Newcastle's one of those great little kind of bubble cities where, you know, they don't want to bring the big names there, so they just rip it off. So instead of Dracula's, they had Cavon Theatre Restaurant where I played Captain Frisky the Pirate. So I've left the Velcro-sided jeans at home tonight. I'm sorry. But that was a lot of good fun. You know, I was a fencing contractor, did work in community gardens. So I did all kinds of stuff. And then when I was 21, I was working as a kitchen hand in Darling Harbour, just above the aquarium there. And I was working with these two Kiwi guys, and they're about my age, and they were, you know, here traveling. They were like telling me about all the great places in Australia they've been to. You know, they've been to the Barrier Reef, they've been to Ayers Rock, they've been to the Kimberley, they've been to the Southern Coast. And they're like, how good's your country, mate? And I was like, oh, yeah, it's pretty good, yeah. And they're like, where, you know, you've been to all that stuff, haven't you? And I was like, no, what is wrong with you? So I went home and had a look at a map of Australia and realised that in my time growing up, my kind of world was as far north as Noosa, as far west as Dubbo, and as far south as Sydney. So if you look at that on a map of Australia, it's pretty small. So I thought I wanted to do something about that. And you know, when you're a kitchen hand, you don't have a lot of money to kind of set off on a big gap year adventure because you don't get paid much as a kitchen hand, but it's still good, honest work. So I thought, how can I do this on the cheap? Oh, no, I'm going to hitchhike around Australia. So I went back to see my family in Scone in the Upper Hunter Valley in New South Wales and told them what I was doing and then walked down to the New England Highway and started hitchhiking. I didn't get a lift that day, funnily enough, but I got picked up by a worker from the abattoir walking home to the caravan park. So I went home with him and had a couple of beers with him and slept on the floor in his caravan. Then went and saw Mum and Dad the next morning and went and had breakfast. I was like, oh, they're like, oh, you're back. I was like, oh, yeah, you know, sorry, I'm false start. So that kind of took me down the southern coast and eventually to Melbourne, which was the very first time I'd visited Melbourne. I was 21 at the time. And I spent a little bit of time here, but I think I was really kind of craving more of the natural space in Australia. So flew over to Tasmania, a very special place. I'm sure many of you have been there. I spent a bit of time travelling around there. I did a forestry blockade for the Weld Valley. Just got swept up into that because there were some other people from Newcastle. And so we all went and climbed trees and chained ourselves to bulldozers, which was fun. But after that, I'd run out of money and didn't really have many job prospects in Tasmania. And that was when someone put me onto woofing, which is what you mentioned before. And I was staying up in Launceston and they're like, yeah, it's great, mate. You just go do it. You know, all you have to do, you sign up, cost you like $50. And you go and do 4 hours work for food and accommodation. And I was like, that sounds like a great idea. You know, a 21-year-old guy, I'm like, I'm going to eat these guys at a house and home. I'm going to wake up at 10, work till 2, and then I'm going to eat. And so I thought, that's great. So I went and joined up, and then you get the little book, and you've got all the lists of the hosts. And I found one that sounded really nice, and it was at a place called Paradise. It's actually on a map. It's just outside of Sheffield in northwest Tasmania at the foothill of Mount Roland there. If you've driven from Devonport to Cradle Mountain, you've probably gone past it. It's a locality. It's not really a town. And it was this old French guy. I didn't really know that until he picked me up because I called, like, his name was G-I-L-L-E-S. And I was like, hey, Gillies. And he's like, it's Gilles. sorry, mate. Sorry, Gilles. And so he'd grown up in Provence and emigrated to Australia in his early 20s as a carpenter, house builder, cabinet maker. And he'd had a successful career. He was in his late 50s when I stayed with him. So he'd bought this 20-acre property and had gone about recreating his childhood and his heritage from the south of France in northern Tasmania. It's a good climate for it. It's got good rainfall, good soil. And so I rocked up, you know, and he's like, Paul, you look terrible, which was true. I did. I was kind of sleeping rough in a swag outside of towns, you know, and he's like, have a cup of tea and go to bed and I'll see you in the morning. I was thinking that, you know, 10 o'clock, here we go. This is great. Life on the farm, 5 o'clock the next morning. Oh gosh, Paul, time to get up. And so I had no idea what I was in for, but that very first morning that he woke me up, it was actually very similar to this time of year. It's that April. And so the pine fruit orchard is in, you know, full swing, and the little kind of cottage where I was staying, that's where the orchard is, straight outside. And he's like, as he'd kind of woken me up and headed back up to the main house, he's like, make sure you pick some fruit for the breakfast from the tree. Now he's got a weird Transylvanian accent. I'm sorry. It's there was the French guy, and then there was his partner, the Count from Transylvania. Make sure you pick some. I'm just not going to do any more accents. So I promise. Probably won't hold that promise. Make sure you pick some fruit from the orchard. And it was one of those beautiful pre-dawn mornings where, you know, it's in the countryside in Tasmania, it gets really misty and the sun's just kind of starting to peek up through the mist and these trees are all dotted through and everything's covered in dew and the apples are the varieties, you know, they were French varieties that he brought over. So they're russeted and they're ugly and they're not like a red delicious. They weren't perfect looking apples, but they were covered in dew. And I picked one off and was like, had a, you know, my jumper pulling them in there. And then I realized as I was doing it, I was like, I have never picked and eaten a piece of fruit straight off a tree before in my life. I'm 21 years old and I've never eaten a piece of fruit off a tree. So I bit it and ate it. And I was like, this is the most amazing thing that I've ever experienced because, you know, it's like dew covered and it's crisp. It's cold because the nights were cold. It was exploding with juice. I'd never tasted an apple like that before. And I think at that very, you know, in that first 15 minutes of being awake on the first day there, I was like, I don't know what's happening here, but I really, really, really like it. And I think, you know, because I didn't have a degree, I didn't have a trade, I didn't have any of that. So I was this kind of directionless 21-year-old just bouncing around the countryside looking for something to stick. Did this, and I was like, Gilles, Gillies, whatever, I don't care. Yes, Paul. you have got the secret for life here. And so in the end, I would work from, you know, I was meant to do 4 hours a day, and in the end, I'd work from sun up to sundown for him. And he loved it. He was like, this is great. I've got like a 21-year-old farm labourer that's happy to work 10 hours a day for food. And, you know, we dug a well, we like planted vegetables, we tended geese and chickens, and we fed the fruit trees. And I used to have to like ride a push bike down to the neighbour's dairy every morning with a basket of the fruit and leave it at the back of the dairy and take glass bottles and turn the vat, and the, you know, they just had a freestanding relationship with the dairy farmer. You know, just help yourself to milk, just leave us some apples. And so it's still warm. Like, it's still warm. It was unpasteurized, it was unhomogenized, straight out of the tank. And I'm like riding on my bike. You know, I started that, I was there for a month, and I started that month, you know, looking really kind of trashed, like bloodshot eyes, not very healthy looking, was kind of probably drinking too much with other travelers. But after a month of this, like waking up at 5 a.m. and eating all this amazing farm food, I was like jumping out of my skin, my eyes were shiny white and like glistening, and I'm like, oh, I'm high on life. Hadn't had a thing to drink in a month because he was a teetotaler. And I realized that I'm like, Gilles, this is, life doesn't get better than this. Like the way that you live, I'd never really been exposed to that kind of life before. I mean, I grew up in regional New South Wales, in a little town called Murrurundi. Has anyone ever been to Murrurundi before? No? Oh, yes! Yeah. What did you guys do in Murrurundi? Hey, from Newcastle. Nice one. The big toe and the top of the head of the Hunter Valley together. Great spot. But, you know, my family background, they weren't farmers. Mum and dad had the local firearm retailing business. So I grew up in the gun shop. It's a true story. Don't mess with me, you bastard, Summer. But really, a lot of their clientele were farmers, but the kind of farmers that I was seeing was that more kind of stereotypical, like 70-year-old bloke in a beaten up Akuba that drives a rusty Land Cruiser ute with a vicious Kelpie on the back, you know, and the kind of fella, it's got no time for snot-nosed little kids. Where's your dad? You know, cause I was always the kind of mascot around. I was like, hey, Mr. Jenkins, where's your father? And no time for small talk with children, these fellas. So farming to me was never something that was really appealing or romanticizing. There was, you know, that there was no that old MacDonald had a farm or small holdings or none of that where I grew up. It was kind of like hard life on the land. I saw this in northern Tasmania. Like, my mind was blown, and I realized that it was the way I wanted to live my life. I wanted to live a life outside with my hands in the soil, with all that kind of movement and activity that goes with it, because and as an extension of that, you always have a great community connection. There's that sharing, there's that bartering. And I thought, really, what loftier aspirations could you have as a human being? But I realized I've got none of the skills. I couldn't grow anything to save myself, and I couldn't really cook. So after spending a month with Gilles, I'm actually going back there this Friday for the first time in 14 years. Just a side note, there you go, full circle. So I called him up a while ago because I've got some time off to go to Tasmania, and he's like, oh, Paul, I was wondering. Oh, Paul, I've told you I'd stop doing accents. I was wondering when you were going to come back. I've been following your career with great interest. I'd love to have you and your family back. So Friday night, I'm going back to where it all began for me. So it's going to be beautiful, and I really hope it's one of those things that I'm sure it's going to be even more magical than I remember it. But after leaving Gilles, I had no idea, you know, how to get started in it. So I kept woofing, kept traveling, and kept trying to work on farms and get that experience up. And then that, you know, it was just a kind of crazy year hitchhiking in Australia. I kind of ended up planting trees in a forestry operation on the Tiwi Islands in the Northern Territory. I got fired from that job from telling the boss to go stuff themselves because they were useless, which is great when you're on a remote island at a remote work camp. And you telling the boss to go stuff themselves was the catalyst for them to quit as well. And then you both sit on the tarmac waiting for the four-seat plane to go back to Darwin after they've just fired you. That was great. That was a great part of my life. That was a real high point. But then, you know, you kind of was making my way back to the Hunter Valley to see my family, and had a really severe car accident. I was traveling as a passenger in a vehicle just north of Rockhampton, and we got knocked off the road by a semi-trailer and totally obliterated, like crushed. It was one of the kind of weirdest and strangest things I'd ever, you know, experienced in my life, and came very close to dying on the side of the Bruce Highway up in North Queensland. So, but, you know, not like as in close to medically dying, just close to like fluke dying. Like, I had a cut on my head and that was it. I remember, you know, that our car got flipped upside down and crushed by the semi-trailer. And I remember when the ambos rocked up, they were like, mate, I've been doing this stretch of road for 20 years. I've seen some of the most horrific car accidents, that would stuff that would make you togas curl, stuff that I lose sleep over every single night. You are by far the luckiest escape I have ever seen. You should be dead. I was like, oh, great, mate. Hey, how good's this? Can I go now? They're like, no, you've got to go to hospital, mate. So that really kind of brought that travelling thing to an end and took me back to Newcastle, great city that it is. And I was doing a lot of work in permaculture and community gardens there, but realised that I still really couldn't cook, that it's all good to grow things, but if you can't cook them, you've kind of lost half the battle. It's like it's a holistic package. Growing and cooking are really two peas in the same pod. So, and I was working as a kitchen hand for a mate on Derby Street. Shout out to those who have been to Newcastle. It's our dazzling dining and entertainment strip. Treat yourself if you ever go up there. It's great. And I was kind of working at this place, and I was working as a kitchen hand, and one of my mates was the head chef. And I was like, oh, Simo, you know, how about you put me on as an apprentice? There you go. And then I'll learn to cook and I'll get paid. I'll have a trade because I don't have any of that yet. And him being the astute kind of, you know, operator that he was, realised that he could work me four times as many hours for half the pay when you go from paying a casual kitchen hand to a full-time apprentice first-year chef. He's like, of course, mate, you start now. So I got swept into that. And I remember I was working up there. I was about 6 months into my apprenticeship and my mate left. There was a new chef and, you know, we didn't really get on. And I was wanting to take that lesson further, my training further. And so I thought, well, you know, I need to go work in a fancy fine dining restaurant. And there was one in Newcastle and they were a two chef team. And I went in and said, do you guys need an apprentice? And they said, no. So I went, okay, I need to go a little bit further afield. So I went to the newsagents and bought the Age Good Food Guide because they, for some reason, had a copy of the Age one tucked away, because New South Wales, obviously, it's the Sydney Morning Herald Good Food Guide, because I didn't want to live in Sydney, because I think, you know, when you're a kid that grows up in New South Wales in a town with 900 people, Sydney trips can be quite scarring to you, especially when you're kind of visiting Sydney in a 60 series Land Cruiser before Google Maps. That was enough to kind of strike it off my places where I want to live. A lot of really kind of bad memories of mum and dad yelling at one another in the front seat. Well, you've really got that turn, you missed that turn. Oh, it's too late. Anyway, we're in Penrith. This is great. So anyway, the holiday's ruined, kids. But Wonderland's in Penrith, Dad. Doesn't matter, we're going home. No, he wasn't really like that. He was a good fella. He is a good fella. So I thought, yeah, I want to live in Melbourne. And I'd had that little trip. You know, that was 21 when I first came to Melbourne, and I was 24 when I came back here as an apprentice chef. I looked up the Good Food Guide, found the restaurant of the year. It was Vudemont at the time, upstairs here now, I believe. Are we in the Rialto building? Wow. I'm going to tell another story about the Rialto building, if that's okay, when we get there. Don't worry. How long have we got, Lucy? How many questions have you got on there?
Take as long as you need. Yeah, okay, I have many more questions, but I'm enjoying the story.
Okay, good. So I thought, you know, if I'm going to do this trade, because chefing is a very difficult trade, but it's also very difficult to do well. I think in any trade, you can be a good tradesperson or a poor tradesperson. And I definitely didn't want to work my butt off and get paid nothing to come out the end of it as a bad tradesperson. So I went and looked at the number one. It was Vudemont. And I didn't even bother sending an email to Jacques Ramon. How I wish I had sent an email to Jacques Ramon now. But sent one to Vudemont going, hey guys, you must get this kind of email all the time, but I'm an apprentice living in New South Wales and I'd really, really love to come and have the opportunity to work for you pretty please, please, I'll do anything. And, you know, they got back to me in about 5 minutes going, sure, come down for a trial. Because what I didn't realise, that restaurants like that are always looking for fresh flesh for the fire. They're like, oh, yes, we'd love to have you, Paul. Come down. Fire up the furnace, Shannon. We've got another one. So, and I spent my week's apprentice wage on accommodation and return flights to Melbourne. I'd never flown to Melbourne before, so I thought, Avalon, great. So I'd only caught, you know, hitchhiked and caught the bus here. And so when I landed halfway to Geelong, I was like, wow, I think that's Melbourne over there. The airport is a really long way from the city. And so after my hour $100 taxi ride, which is half of my next week's wage, I kind of got to the city. I did a walk by past it. You know, this big red door up there on Little Collins Street where it used to be, and I kind of stood outside. I was like, yeah, I'm going in there tomorrow. I'm going to smash it. And then went to my hostel, which was the night of one of the World Cup games, and it was like I was in there with all these British people. It was the worst night's sleep I've ever had. Anyway, so I go there the next morning, do one of the most difficult job trials of my life. The restaurant I've been working at in Newcastle was this kind of like breakfast, lunch, dinner, all day, casual dining, cafe kind of space. You know, the kitchen was right on the street. Everyone knew everyone. We're always like chatting with our mates as they're walking past. Hey guys, what's going on? You going for a surf? Great. See you after work. And so I get in here and I'm kind of standing out the front. And Tuesday morning in any sort of fine dining restaurant, especially if they shut Sunday, Monday, is like, other than Friday or Saturday night dinner service, is the most intense time to be there. Because everyone's come in from their days off. You're basically re-prepping the whole menu from scratch because it's, you know, when you're cooking food like that, you kind of can't just leave it in the fridge for 2 days. It's got to be done on the day of. And there was about 30 chefs. The biggest kitchen I'd ever been in was about 4, and there was 30 chefs. Every available piece of bench space was totally taken. And in the end, I went upstairs and they're like, there you go, here's the change room, get in your whites, come on down, we'll get you into it. And I remember standing there by myself in this change room going, I could just probably sneak out the back door right now. You know, it's going to maybe just go out for a coffee and some lunch, and it was just a nice little 2-day holiday to Melbourne. Great. But in the end went, okay, no, you're here to do this, and the rest is kind of history for that.
So was that your first and last chefing experience?
I had a few other bits and bobs around the place, you know, but I think that was definitely the penultimate chefing experience for me. It's when you work in a place like that, I'd imagine it's what it's like for kind of big-time sports people or big-time entertainers or something like that, then once you've played in the big game, you either love it and you keep doing that, or you just go and do something else. Because it's kind of hard to go back, you know, playing club footy after you've, you know, worked at a restaurant with the biggest collection of Dom Perignon in the Southern Hemisphere, you know. But on the same hand, I realised that wasn't for me in any stretch. So I've done a lot of different jobs.
Yeah. So we ran an article about you on the Design Files last week, and if you caught it, and one of the things you mentioned was about this, well, your belief that it's so important now more than ever to be growing our food and our produce locally. Why is that so crucial?
So I think for me anyway, I'm sure there's like some really kind of hard science behind why it's so crucial and so important. But for me, I mean, we turn on the news. We all know that the kind of planet's going to hell in a handbasket, right? Like we've, you know, climate change is a happening thing, like where there's so little action coming from the kind of the levels of government that we would entrust to take action for us, that it can be quite depressing, I guess is the word. And I mean, and I'm not just making that up. Like there's climate anxiety is like actually a recognized medical condition. I don't think I suffer from it, but you know, when we're constantly drilled to that bad news, and I've got kids, I'm like, what kind of planet have I brought them into? For me, gardening and in particular food growing is that way of taking some sort of action back. It's something that's literally, well, maybe not grassroots, but lettuce roots, you know, because, you know, you can't eat grass. So I want it to be like a vegetable root movement rather than a grassroots movement. Thanks. I really should like test these jokes on people before. That's a good thing, I guess, as a comedian, they actually get a routine that they test. I just make it up and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So, but yeah, it's that act of being able to do something that makes a really significant impact on the kind of, you know, the footprint that you have in this world. And through that, you can connect to your environment, your place, your own health, your family, your community. And it's empowering, and it's an act of optimism. You know, when you grow something, when you plant a seed, it is optimism embodied, you know, because you don't plant and go, oh well, what next? You're planting this seed with the hope that it will grow and feed you at the end and be a healthy plant. And so I think for me that the food growing is a critical reason for that. I mean, and also because we're in this transition from, well, I don't even know transition's the right word, but where the majority of our food is created in a huge industrial complex. It's a relatively modern phenomena, and we're seeing it contribute to a whole raft of personal, physical and societal problems, environmental problems. And that's because for so long in human history, in fact, you know, the bulk, the 99.9% of human history, we've had to have some sort of connection and engagement with the food that we grow. It's such a modern convenience. But when it's been so essential to our existence for so long, our brains are hardwired to want it. That when we remove that, we've got all these satisfaction and happiness and joy mechanisms that come from growing food and sharing food with the community, because for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, that meant we stayed alive. So our brain went, oh, I like this. I like growing carrots. It means I can grow carrots again tomorrow. It means my kids are going to eat carrots. It means my tribe's going to eat carrots. So, yeah, I think that food growing is really a fundamental part of humanity and something that is somewhat of a, to me, a bit of a magic bullet for so many of the ailments of modern society, whether they be physical or societal or environmental or emotional, that there's so much in food growing that can really combat all of that. So I think, yeah, the more people growing food, the better.
Totally. That brings us to the episode of Catalyst that you recently hosted about this subject, and that there were a lot of pretty shocking statistics in that episode around, you know, I guess what really needs to change if the population keeps growing, because we're sort of not, you know, currently on a trajectory that's sustainable. So can you tell us just a little bit about, I guess, that episode, like the sort of that industrialization of food and the challenges there?
Yeah, so I think for Australia, I mean, we've got a relatively small population. So I think that the problem with industrial agriculture in Australia isn't so much the ability for it to sustain our population. It's the fact that modern agriculture is an extractive process, and we are looking at, in fact, we're trying to position ourselves both through policy and business action as being the food bowl of Oceania and Asia. And so the problem with that is I mean, I don't have a problem with us growing food to feed our neighboring countries. That's a very admirable thing. What I do think the problem is that, as I mentioned, agriculture is an extractive process, or has the potential to be a very extractive process. And we live on the oldest continent on the planet with the poorest topsoils. And if you think that we can just keep growing food in Australia and sending it out and using synthetic fertilizers to prop up our soils, we're in for a really hard landing, because it's not possible. And in fact, they've kind of, some soil scientists are quite alarmed at the very small future they see for Australian topsoils. So, I mean, that's one huge problem. The other problem about the industrial food system is the centralization of it. So a centralized system like an industrial food complex isn't necessarily very robust to change. It has a power in size. And I mean, we certainly count ourselves very lucky to be able to be in a country where we have food security. You know, we would assume there's not one person in this room tonight going to go home and go, I don't know where my next meal's going to come from, or I'm concerned that I'm not going to be able to get fruit and vegetables to feed my children tomorrow, whereas that affects many people in the world. So we have that lucky part of it, but it's not to say that it'll be like that forever. And especially when we have a rapidly shifting climate, I mean, this last summer in Australia has been a prime example. You know, we've got fires in Tasmania, floods in North Queensland, all of New South Wales in drought, while Western Australia is having the best summer they've ever had. There's all this like high variability, and our food crops, which are a very narrow genetic pool because they're from a centralized food system and we only like to grow one type of wheat or two types of wheat, one type of beef, one type of barley, those plants aren't as adaptable as a decentralized food growing system where people have got all this amazing genetic diversity and they're selecting their own seeds and they're selecting seeds and genetic materials that are adapting to their local climate. So I think that the industrial system is not equipped to be able to face the shifting goalposts of a changing climate, but local food certainly is. And I mean, the UN has backed the statement that small farms can feed the planet, because it's the kind of the big ag line that it's like, oh yeah, you might have your little farm with your little horse and, you know, your little dairy cow and your chickens, but it's not going to feed the planet. We're going to feed the planet with our massive like 1,000-acre properties, our commodity farming. But in fact, that especially in a lot of developing nations, that the introduction of that kind of complex reduces food security, because farmers stop growing food and they start growing commodities. They stop growing foods for their families, for their villages, along with little cash crops for markets, and they just start growing wheat for export, which is great if you get paid so that you can then go buy food, but crap if you have a bad year and you don't, whereas they would have had the resilience of a small diversified farm previously.
It reminds me, we had a chat with Joost Bakker here last year, and it's really similar sort of, yeah, similar subject matter. And he's obsessed with soil as well.
Yeah. Well, so the best farmers I know consider themselves as soil farmers first and foremost, no matter what they grow, except they're kind of like fish guys, like they don't really care about the soil as much.
Understandably.
but they do care that the people in the catchment areas of their fisheries care about soil, because all that runoff can have a significant impact on their fishery health.
Yeah. You're also a huge advocate for community, and you grew up in a town of, you said, 900 people.
900 people.
So what have you learned about community, and how do you think people, especially people who live in the city, like many of the people in this room, can maybe sort of, I don't know, build a sense of community even in, you know, an urban sort of environment.
So I think you really hit the nail on the head there, Lucy, with the term build a community. Because what I came to realize that, well, I didn't realize until I moved to the city actually, but growing up in a small town, you know, stuff was always happening. There was like amateur drama, there was cricket matches, there was all this kind of great. There was two things so I'm really kind of struggling to think of more. We had street parties, we had billy cart races, we had all that kind of stuff. It was great. And in hindsight, looking back on it, I feel so grateful to have experienced that as a kid. But in hindsight, I've realized that the only reason that stuff was happening was because there were people within the community spending time in addition to their full-time jobs putting that stuff on, you know, and they it's just the way it was. You know, you kind of, oh, you do this and you do the volunteer bushfire brigade and you do the sausage sizzle down at the footy in winter and you do the, you know, the canteen and the cricket in summer, because it's such a small town that everyone's always kind of pitching in. And so I guess it wasn't until I came to the city and I realized that, I mean, in the city we're so spoilt for cultural activities, sporting activities, every sort of subculture, niche you can name, there's something here for you. And chances are you don't have to organize anything to do it. You can just go out and participate in it, because there's such a huge market of or population of people that I think, I'm guilty of it myself, often taking for granted that it's actually people, volunteers, people adding their passion and their time to make those things happen. So definitely growing up in regional Australia, I think the thing that I took away from that as it relates to community is that if you want it, you do it, you make it, you know, and usually people are really, really happy to support it because people want to do stuff. We want to live interesting lives. We want to spend time with our friends in our communities at parties, at festivals, at great sporting galas, all this kind of stuff. But unless someone puts the effort in to put that on, it never happens. So that's definitely something that was instilled in me from a young age. And I think really it kind of happened through mum and dad. They were, whenever my sister or I like joined up for a sport team, they kind of joined the board, not as like kind of weird psychopathic soccer mum and dads like, Paul's going to be the captain, all right? I'm the treasurer and the president, so Paul's going to be the captain of the under-12s cricket team, right? But more so filling a vacuum of people to be like, we really need a treasurer. Anyone want to put their hand up, please? Otherwise, the club's going to fold. And they go, okay. And again, it wasn't until I reflected on it in later life that whenever they joined the kind of board, all of a sudden we had like a new canteen or new change rooms, or the tennis courts would get resurfaced, or we'd play an inter-district round robin where like 25 teams from different towns in the Hunter Valley and New England, Liverpool, Plains region would come and play. Our team always had nice hats. Our cricket team, we had like the baggy, you know, we had our own little like baggy greens, except they were red and blue, the colour of the mighty Morundi Mavericks. And I just thought that's the way it was. I just thought that's the way kids' community sport was. But it wasn't until I realised that it was mum and dad organising fundraisers, calling other clubs saying, do you want to do this? Come on, we'll have a great day. Bring the kids up. We'll put on a big, you know, a big sausage fest. Sausage sizzle. Oh, sorry. Growing up in the country. Love those sausage fests up there in the Upper Hunter Valley. Yeah. So you get out what you put in. That's the abstract of that when it comes to community.
I do want to get on to River Cottage.
Okay.
So first up, how did you get the gig?
People ask me this all the time because everyone wants to be on telly, or maybe not everyone, but there's a lot of people out there that want that, like, man, how did you do it? Especially a lot of my friends in the hospitality industry, like really good chefs, are like, where'd you get the break in telly, Westy? Tell us. Who did you talk to? And I like universally disappoint them when I say I filled out an online application. They're like, what? That's it? That's all you've got for me? So I was living in Tasmania and I was growing veggies in a backyard and had chooks and working as a chef. And one of my wife's cousins, who was part of the Age Food team at the time, was like, oh, they're making a River Cottage Australia. Paul should apply. I think he'd be great for it. And I was a huge fan of the UK series because obviously that was the articulation of that experience that I had on that farm in Tasmania on TV. I was like, God, this Hugh guy, he knows what's going on. This is great. It's just like Gilles and Hugh. But then I thought, you know, oh, geez, I don't know, because I knew how popular River Cottage UK is. It's so popular, like globally popular, except in the States. They hate him in America for some reason. I don't know. They've just never been able to crack the US market with it. What's his last name? Sorry, that's bad accents again. I promise someone, that was an American one, just so you know, just to clear that up. I feel like I need subtitles for my accents. Indistinct American Chatter would have been the subtitle for that one. So, and I was really resistant to apply at first. I was like, oh, yeah, I don't know, I probably would be able to do it, but I don't know. It was around the same time that Top Gear Australia had been around. I don't know if anyone remembers that. Probably blink if you miss it. Blink and you'd miss it. And to me, that was kind of like a hugely popular UK series, global appeal, personality-driven, Australian adaptation, failed miserably, you know. And I'm not Shane Warne or Shane Jacobson, so I don't know that I could have bounced back from that. If I, you know, I felt like if I had got it and it had flopped, I'd have sort of been, you're that guy that ruined River Cottage, aren't you? I remember you. Like 20 years down the track, someone would be like, oh, I know your face, mate. Yeah, you're the fella that ruined River Cottage. Yeah, terrible that show was. So I didn't apply. And then on the last day, the literal last day of applications, I went, oh, well, couldn't hurt, could it? I'm not going to get it. So, and I actually had the day off, and it wasn't until about like 5 o'clock in the evening. I was like, oh, I'm sure it's just like, you know, write your name and address and hit send. Turns out it was this like 5-page questionnaire. It was like an eco dating site. It was like, what are your thoughts on sustainability? Describe your dream property. What does community mean to you?
Like all the questions I'm asking you tonight.
This is great. It's like, you know, who inspires you? And I'm like, I don't know if you've ever seen Chef's Type, but it's a sight. And so, you know, I got the two fingers of fury out. Oh, my God, this is so intense. It was the longest thing I'd written since leaving high school. There's not a great need for literacy in the hospitality industry. So I'm like, oh man, I can't even remember how to spell. Thank God I saw the computer, it's spell checking it for me. And so it was this huge thing, and I sent it off at like 5 minutes to midnight. I was like, oh, phew, that's done. I'm going to bed. And the next morning I was in the kitchen and I had my phone with me, which is very rare, very unprofessional, but I had it because I was the only one in the kitchen that morning. And the phone, it was like 9:05 and the phone was ringing. It was a New South Wales number. I'm like, oh, it's Telstra. As I answered, I'm like, yes. And they're like, and this kind of sprightly voice down the other end of the line go, g'day, Paul, it's Pete Tame here, casting director for River Cottage Australia. How's it going, mate? And I was like, oh, yeah, good. Yeah, good. And he's like, well, I just read your application. It was long, could you believe? But we really liked it. But, you know, it's for a TV show. I'm like, yeah, it's for River Cottage. Yeah, I know all about it. Love River Cottage. He's like, yeah, we're going to need to see a photo. We're going to see a picture or something of you. You know, it reads well and you sound all right over the phone, but it's, you know, we kind of need to know what you, how you look and talk on telly, you know, because it's a TV show. I'm like, all right. Could you film a little video doing something River Cottage-y for us and send it up? I was like, yeah, no worries, mate. So being a chef, this was in December, and it's the silly season in hospitality because of how much you're working, not because of all the great kind of office parties you get to go to. So the only day I had off was Christmas Day. So my wife and I filmed me cooking Christmas lunch. We went to a friend's place. We picked some blueberries. We made that into dessert. The blueberry tree was wrapped with like bird netting, and I kind of frivolously ran around the tree and unwrapped it going, the joys of Christmas, which apparently was one of the things that got me over the line. In the end, he was like, oh, and I remember you unwrapping that blueberry bush and was very impressed. I was like, I'm so glad I did that. And then, you know, went home and downloaded some like freeware video editing software and put together the worst piece of like a videography, cinematography editing anyone's probably ever seen in their life. And it was just kind of left it at the end. There was no like finale to it. I was like, they're going to get the idea by now. Hit send. And then the next morning, I'm kind of like Boxing Day, woke up like looking at my phone, 9 o'clock, any minute now. 9:05, still nothing, you know, because being in hospitality, I kind of assume everyone just works over the summer, but they had kind of done that as the last thing before going on 2 weeks holiday over January, December, and then that passed, and then I got a phone call in the first week of January going, oh, g'day, Paul, it's Pete Tame here again. We liked your video. We'd like to fly up to Sydney for a screen test. I was like, oh, wow, flying to Sydney. He's like, have you never flown before? And I was like... So no, I have, mate. Thank you. I'm a New South Wales-born Tasmanian person. And so I went up there, left Tasmania, left Hobart. It was 6 degrees. It was January, I think, the 25th. Important detail. not really, but 6 degrees was, because when I went to Sydney, it was at that stage Sydney's hottest day on record, and it was like 43 degrees. And we're in a community garden, and I'm like melting, and everyone's got hats and sunglasses on, and I had my hat and sunglasses. I'm like, they're like, take off the hat and sunglasses. Like, but it's like 40 degrees around the middle of the sun. What is wrong? Welcome to television, Sunny Jim. Take off the hat and the glasses. I'm sitting there and I'm melting, and I've got sweat dripping off the end of my nose. And I thought, well, this went well. And then flew back to Tasmania that night. So it was a day trip, 6 degrees, got the flu, was sick for 2 weeks. And so they were kind of like, oh, okay. And that was it. And then they're like, oh, you're on the short list. You know, you're down to six. I'm like, oh, yeah. This is exciting. And everyone's kind of going, you're going to get it. You're going to get it, Westy. You're going to get it. Yes. I'm like, oh, I'm never going to get it. Shut up. Stop filling my mind with these false hopes. And then so I'm in the kitchen on a Friday afternoon about 5 o'clock. I was running that service. I was working in a really nice Tasmanian, Italian family restaurant. So it was kind of like where these two cousins owned it, and all their cousins worked there, and their nonna worked there, and it was this massive family thing. And they'd been kind of following with interest and going, boy, I'm not going to do the accent, boy, because it's going to be put on the podcast. I'm so embarrassed. I'm going to have to edit those out. Okay. No, I can't help with it. It's going to be the worst accent, so I'm not going to do it. They're like, Wesley, mate, you've got it. You've got it. You're in the bag. Anyway, 5 o'clock, phone rings. I'm like, it's the TV mob. And they're like, okay, everyone kind of gathers around. So I'm on the phone. I've got like eight people kind of crushed around behind me like this. I'm standing behind a combi oven. The first customers are going to come, and there's no one in, like no staff in the restaurant, because they're all in this scrum around me. And it's the executive producer, and he's like, oh, g'day, Paul. Dave Galloway here from ITV Studios. He doesn't sound like this either. Sorry if you listen to this, gal. You sound so much cooler than that. He's like, you know how you told us that, you know. Oh, no, he's like, can you drive a manual? And I'm like, yes. Good. You know how you said that if you were to get the job, you'd need like 3 weeks to get up here? And I was like, yeah. He's like, is that still standing? And I'm like, yeah, 3 weeks. That should be about right. And he's like, that's good, because you got 3 weeks to get up here. You got the job. Congratulations. And so I'm like, whereas like all the crew of the restaurant are like, yeah. I'm like, I'm just still standing like this. He's like, you there? I'm like, yep. Yeah, I'm here. He's like, look, it's Friday afternoon, so I thought I'd let you know now, just so you can have the weekend to digest it, and we'll give you a call on Monday, and, you know, we'll take from there. That's great if you work in an office. Friday afternoon, really good time to give someone that kind of news so they can digest it over their two relaxing days off. Really, really bad time to tell a chef who is literally having the first customers of a twin sitting, fully booked dinner service sitting down as the docket machine starts to go. That's pretty much how I cooked that whole night. I was just like. And then so the other kind of twist of that evening was that I'd made this secret pact with myself that if I got the job, I'd ask my now wife to marry me, because it was such a big, like, she was going to have to stay in Tassie, you know, like this kind of stuff is like a huge life-changing thing. So I wanted to make sure that she knew that if I took it, it was like there was a commitment there. And so I'm like, oh, I've got the job, oh, now I've got to go. I can't believe now I've got to ask Alicia to marry me. Oh, I didn't think that was going to happen. Oh, I didn't think I was going to have to do that, but I've made this stupid pact with myself and now I've got to go home and do it. So I'm like, and I used to live like 45 minutes from the restaurant on the South Peninsula. Has anyone been to the South Arm Peninsula? You know, Bruny Island? Yeah, of course. It's opposite that, other side of the Derwent. It's Bruny Island's attached, lesser attractive sibling. So 45 minutes, I'm like, okay, I've got it. You know, because my mum had sent this ring down, one of my grandmother's rings ages ago. Yeah, well, Mum, what's this for, Mum? She's like, I don't know. You'll find something to do with it. All right, Mum. So anyway, that was hidden in the laundry. I'm like, okay, I had this great plan. I had 45 minutes to plan it. I'm going to like, oh, hey, babe, I'm just going to have a quick shower, you know, get the thing out of the laundry, come out, do it. But my wife had been working that night as well, because she was in hospitality, and I get home and she's like on the couch like this with like half a drunk bottle of wine. Hey, babe, I'm so tired. Oh, how was work? Good. It was good. So I'm like, I can't do it tonight. So I'm like lying in bed that night, because I'm like, I can't. I'm going to ask her first and then tell her that I got the River Cottage job. Very underhanded on my behalf in hindsight. So I'm like lying there. I can't do it now. Damn it. She's like, you seem really stressed out tonight, babe. What's going on? Like, are you having trouble sleeping? Oh, you know, just wound up from work. Still, I just had a coffee a bit late. Oh, my God, I'm going to be the host of River Cottage. I'm going to ask you to marry me tomorrow. But anyway, the next day, did it. It was nice. I was at home. She finished work. I was like, oh, my God, I love you. Will you marry me? And she's like, yes. And I was like, and by the way, I got the job and I'm moving to New South Wales in 3 weeks. I think I was still down there like this. I was like, and by the way. She's like, what? Okay, but yes. So, yeah, there's.
That is the best story. No one has ever given us their proposal story as part of this event. So I feel quite
special.
There's
like a family update about job prospects. It's like, hey, will you marry? By the way, I got the promotion, babe. Great.
I've asked you like 3 questions.
Okay, good.
And we're nearly at time.
Okay, sorry.
So I'm just going to ask you one more and then.
You guys have been ripped off. Sorry.
No. You've answered many me having to ask a question, which is so efficient. But I'm going to ask you one more and then I'm going to open to the crowd.
Okay.
So you've achieved so much already. You seem to have done a lot in your, you know, not that many years on the planet. So what is one thing that you haven't done yet that you really still want to do?
Oh, geez, that's a good question. One thing that I haven't done that won a seat in the Australian Senate. No, just kidding. Let me think.
They need you.
Yeah, no, come on. We'll call it here. Let's form a party right now. We'll all get signatories to it. One thing that I... Sorry, you're like,
no, that's
like,
right.
You're going to have to listen to my thinking sounds now. One thing that I haven't done that I really wanted to do. That's a tough one.
Could be a good time to plug the book that you're writing.
Oh, yeah, okay, thanks. I want my book to sell out. That's one thing that I want to do that hasn't happened yet. No, I think just to go back to that last question, for me now I've got kids, what I want to do that I haven't done yet is to raise happy, confident, competent young adults. So I don't know. I think I'm going all right. I don't know. They're 4 and 2, so they're not dead yet. No broken bones to speak of. So I think that's probably, you know, aside from the career type focus and stuff, but to be able to see my boys, you know, thrive and be happy and have a good life is really, really what I want. And I also want to tell you about my book.
I want to hear about your book.
Okay. So one of the reasons why I moved to Melbourne was to write a book. It was really kind of a 2-pronged reason for moving, or 3-pronged. There'll be 3 succinct prongs, don't worry. It's just like a little oyster fork rather than a carving fork, don't worry. So one was because my wife's a Melbourne girl, all of her friends were having kids, she was having kids, we'd lived away from Melbourne for 7 years, she wanted to catch up and been in Melbourne with her friends, which I was like, okay, I'm happy for that, I love Melbourne. And we'd actually come down here in August 2017 to do the baby tour for baby number 2, you know, the whole Lion King, here it is everyone, look what we did, bring your gifts and adulation, look at this small human that we have created, thank you. Which went well. And then while I was down here, I've really been trying to pitch the idea of like an urban river cottage to broadcasters, but they just weren't into it, unfortunately. So I took the concept, repackaged it as a book, not under the River Cottage banner, and I took it to one publisher and they picked it up that day,
which was great.
Yeah, which was really good. And so that's Plum Publishing, which is a Melbourne-based publisher here, the food imprint of Pan Mac, and they're a food publishing powerhouse and they're a really amazing team. So they're like, we love it. We want to do it. Here's the contract. I was like, okay. And I didn't really want to do it in Newcastle on the South Coast to write a book about urban food growing. You have to put your money where your mouth is and be in the urban environment. So that wrapped up, or my part of that book wrapped up about 3 weeks ago. Now it's in the design phases, which I just kind of go, I like it. It's pretty. That's really nice. I don't have much of like a design aesthetic, which is great because I'm here with the design files. So maybe if I could just like share some of the design, you know, proofs, I think is that the right term?
With the TDF.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Community, and we could do it together. And actually, that's kind of brought our time in Melbourne to an end. So I'm going to Tasmania for 3 weeks on Friday. And then I only really come back to Melbourne for 2 weeks to pack up home, and then we go on a little bit of a woofing adventure. So I get to go, I'm going and taking the whole family to stay with Gilles for a week, which is for me a really kind of nice thing because I guess the last, in particular since River Cottage, the last 7 years have been really crazy. You know, it's one of those life events that you could never see coming that totally changes everything about your life, well, a great deal about your life. And it's been kind of machine gun rapid since that happened. So it's nice now to be able to take a little bit of time to reflect and turn that circle, the full rotation, and go back to the farm where it all began for me and let Jill's work me 10 hours a day again. Oh, Paul, you're back. We can dig another well now next to the first well you dug. Oh, you're getting old and fat now, Paul, aren't you? Oh, keep working. And then we're going up the East Coast on a woofing tour of a lot of friends and families. We've got a lot of friends up on the kind of mid-North Coast, North Coast, Southeast Queensland. And then the book comes out at the end of September, and then it's back to beautiful Bermagui on the far South Coast for us. To my oldest son to start school next year. So there you go. Now you know my life story. There you go. So $22 well spent, hey?
That sounds so good. I wish I could have asked you all my other questions, but instead I'm going to open to the crowd. If anyone has time or has a question, we don't really have time, but we're going to just spend another 5-10 minutes if anyone has a question for Paul.
People, I was about to say people are afraid because they're like, oh, I don't want to hear the answer.
Down here, there's a microphone for you.
I've got to get home.
2-minute
I've got
answer.
Work tomorrow.
Cap.
Okay, 2 minutes.
2 minutes.
When it comes to your urban farming, what have been the most challenging things that you face and how did you overcome them?
So when it comes to urban growing, I think definitely space is always a big constraint, but it also fires a lot of creativity. I mean, when you're on 20-acre property, space is almost a burden. You know, you're like, you've got to fence that and do this and, you know, you've got so much space. But when you're in a backyard, you do have a really finite amount of space to deal with. So it's a constraint, but it's also a great firer for creativity in that space because you tend to think about it a lot more and try to think about to get the most productive space. The other one's rats in my compost. I always like have massive, like I love composting, live to compost. And I've had to really kind of, you know, Fort Knox my compost heaps so they don't turn into urban rat farms because on the, you know, out in the country, you've got all kind of like, you've got cats and owls and snakes and all that kind of stuff that keeps the rat population down. But in the city, yeah, like after moving into a house in Thornbury, I've been there for about 3 weeks and there's this rat explosion. I'm like, oh, city living, eh? And then I noticed they were all eating my compost. And I was like, oh, we should probably do something about that. So, I mean, you've got the pests. So, yeah, urban pests are definitely a big one, rats and the constraint of space. But really, like, I don't think there's a huge amount. I think if you wanted to grow vegetables commercially in the city environment, it's challenging, but it's not, you know, everything is a two-sided coin. So you've got the challenges of limited space in the urban environment. But you've also got like a relatively affluent market who really wants to buy that produce that you might not get if you were growing those vegetables in a regional town, you know, where you've got a 50-acre property, but you've got 500 people that shop at the IGA and don't want to spend that money on, you know, small farm grown vegetables. So, yeah, I mean, living in Thornbury in that north of me, I've got like 3 minutes already, haven't I?
Yeah, I've lost count.
Okay, so just the you know, we've got a fantastic Greek and Italian migrant community and also Eastern Europeans, and they come from a long history of growing food in limited spaces. And some of the gardens are just incredible. Go for a walk around your neighbourhood if you live in the north, or even just drive up there and walk, and you'll see some amazing food gardens where their neighbours have just got lawns or, heaven forbid, astroturf. You've got, you know, beautiful walnut trees and persimmons and lemon trees and olive trees and all these vegetables growing underneath them and chickens. It's great. Yep. You can do a lot in a small space.
There's people growing veggies on nature strips in Rock and Thornbury.
Go for
I love
gold.
That.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just wasted land.
Any other questions? Yes, one down here.
Hi. So I think you're kind of preaching to the choir a little bit with the people in this room. But
good.
When it comes to the producers and the consumers of food, what would be your advice in terms of trying to change behaviour of that Hilux driving, gun-toting person in New South Wales or the person in Fiji who needs to use sustainable fertiliser, you know, how do you reach those people?
Yeah, so I think that for those it's – and I think River Cottage kind of did a good job at this because it wasn't particularly preachy. It was more celebratory. So, I mean, so, like I love getting on my soapbox and preaching to the converted, testify everyone here, hallelujah. Let's grow our food. But when I think when you showcase a lifestyle in the celebratory kind of sense, showing the quality of life that can be had there, the second you tell someone they should be doing something is the second that they don't want to do it. And then they're never going to do it. You should be growing more vegetables. Okay. Back in my Hilux. This is great. But I think that when you can show that quality of life and you can show the benefit that comes from it, I mean, it's a great question, and it's a very pointed question, because that is the great challenge, that there is a very small, engaged niche of our community, of our society, that spends a lot of time talking to themselves about how important it is, but getting zero traction in the kind of community at large. So, I mean, I think the best way is to do it yourself. And that's that kind of grassroots notion of it spreading. Like, I don't really think we're going to see any kind of urban farming or regenerative agriculture policy anytime soon. Maybe in Darabin, or definitely in Darabin. It's probably got lots of urban farming policy. But it's that kind of thing where you're out the front, you're growing vegetables in your front yard, your neighbor pulls up. They're like, "What are you doing here, mate?" And you're like, "Oh, you know, I'm growing some veggies here. Have some." They take it home. They go, "That was some of the best parsley I've ever eaten. That apple was delicious. Thanks, mate." And just those little kind of hooks. I don't know that it's going to be like one of those things where, you know, we kind of proactively change as a society and realize the importance of growing food. But I think in any sort of post-trauma society, growing food is one of the most important aspects of it. So it's definitely an important craft to have, because if the industrial food complex even hiccups, we're stuffed. Look what happened. I mean, even in Australia, you think it'll never happen here. Queensland floods, I think it was 2013. And, you know, you can still see on YouTube the footage of all the supermarkets stripped bare, because people go into kind of like pillage mode. They're like, "Oh my God, the food truck can't get through. Let's buy everything in the shop." So, yeah, having that resilience in the community is, I think, an important thing as well.
Do we have one final question?
One final question.
No pressure.
Oh, yes. You, what, sir, in the back.
So you've got a lifetime of experience from good mate Gilles.
Yes.
All the way through River Cottage, and you're going to go and start a new life in Bermagui. I'm guessing it's on not a quarter acre, but a few acres.
No, it's on 800 square metres.
Okay.
In the middle of town. That's another star. Oh God, so many stories. But yeah, no, not on a property.
What will be the first thing you'll do up there based on all the experience you've had so far?
Plant trees, plant fruit trees. There's a great saying that the best time to plant a tree was yesterday, because they can take a very long time to grow, to reach maturity. You can sow radishes and get a harvest in 2 weeks, but you can't plant a walnut tree and get a harvest for 10 years, you know, or an avocado tree, all that kind of stuff. So actually the first thing I'm probably going to do up there is actually in the first year not plant a lot, to kind of take that proactive time to watch how the sun moves across the space, watch how water moves across the space with decent rainfall, and design a garden that really works for that space and that climate. Meanwhile, just growing vegetables and get a massive compost heap going as well.
Paul, I wish we could talk all night, but we're going to wrap it up here. And I'm sure Paul will stick around if you want to say hi now. We'll lock him here to say hello to everyone before.
We can sit in this lovely car over here. Maybe? No, probably not. Okay, that's fine.
Please join me in thanking Paul West for such a wonderful discussion. You.
Pretty under the radar when it comes to social media, but you can follow his Instagram adventures at _Paul_West_. We recently ran a feature story on Paul where he shares his wisdom and advice about growing your own food, even in the city. You can revisit that story via the link in our show notes. And as mentioned in our discussion, Paul's book on urban farming will be out via Plum Books later this year. We'll be sure to keep you posted. You've been listening to TDF Talks, a podcast from The Design Files, Australia's most popular design blog. All the links mentioned in this episode can be found in our show notes at thedesignfiles.net/podcast. Please also do check out our main website, thedesignfiles.net, where we post new stories 3 times a day featuring Australian design, art, architecture, and more. Thank you so much for tuning in, and if you've enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe to TDF Talks on iTunes. Thanks for listening.